Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VC Bruna podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Sushma Kaushik, partner at Avishkar Capital. Avishkar Capital is an early stage VC firm and the equity arm of the Avishkar Group, which is focused on developing the impact ecosystem in Asia and Africa. The VC firm manages close to $500 million in AUM and has invested in notable companies like Checkbook, AgroStar, Soulful, Utkarsh Small Finance Bank, among others. Sushma has close to 18 years of diverse experience in the field of early stage investing, small business incubation, and consulting across sectors. An ISB Hyderabad alum, Sushma has also been recognized as 40 under 40 alternative investment professionals in India in 2017, and also as one of the top 100 women in finance in the leading category. In this episode, Sushma talks about her path leading up to venture capital, the genesis of Avishkar Capital and its key portfolio startups, the evolution of the fund's thesis across four different funds, unlocking of the massive Bharat opportunity, the evolving exit landscape for impact funds, and key learnings from Sushma's decadal experience as a VC. I had a lot of takeaways from my chat with Sushma, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Sushma has to share. Hey Sushma, welcome to the VC Pruna podcast. Excited to have you with us today.
Thanks, Digjay. It's wonderful to be here today.
Awesome. So, you know, for our listeners who don't know you yet, maybe we can start with a brief intro about yourself and tell us about your path leading up to venture capital.
Sure. No, happy to share my journey so far. It's been a very exciting journey. And I will be upfront in saying that I've pretty much been like Destiny's Child, have landed up in all the right places and have got all the right opportunities. So I'm quite grateful for that. So very quickly, I'm an engineering graduate, did my engineering from Bangalore, graduated at the peak of the dot-com bust, ended up with two jobs which got deferred. And so I was at a fork at crossroads. Either I could go on to study more, had lots of options to go abroad to do my master's or to go into entrepreneurship. I guess I have an affinity towards, a bias towards action. And so entrepreneurship was my calling. And that's where I moved on. I had a four-year stint as an entrepreneur. And I must say, it was a very humbling experience very early on in my career to have that. And I guess that's what keeps me a little more grounded because I understand what entrepreneurship means. And so, you know, post my entrepreneurship in a real estate venture, I went on to do my business school from the ISB Hyderabad. And I was one of the few lucky ones to land a job on the buy side of real estate private equity. Back in the day, this is around 2006, 2007, buy side jobs were far and few. And that added a lot of experience in understanding the analytical process of investing. Private equity investing is far more analytical, a lot of data-driven exercise that goes into it. So I was with a very large global private equity fund called Starwood Capital. It gave me fantastic experience and the rigor that goes into investing, worked with cross-cultural teams. And they were really interesting times because back in the day, we didn't have very rich databases to fall back on to take investment decisions. And so we had to actually do a lot of our investing research grounds up. So that really taught us to go into first principles when collecting data before taking investing decisions. Mm-hmm. Around that time is when, you know, the startup ecosystem was developing quite rapidly in India. And I was, again, itching to work with entrepreneurs again. The VC ecosystem was also evolving. And that's when I came across Avishkar Capital, which at that point in time was a very active micro VC fund. I call it micro VC because it had two small funds. One was a $14 million fund. The other was an $18 million fund. And they were one of the most active investors in that period. And that's what excited me to work with them. And they had a very interesting thesis. They were working on an impact theme of investing. And then, as they say, the rest is history. I've been here for almost 11 years now. It has been fantastic. So although we are an investor, it has been a significant entrepreneurial journey. We started with, as I said, you know, small funds of $30 million. And today we manage over $400 million in equity assets and equal amount or larger in debt assets as well. So it's been interesting. And let's see where we go from here.
That's wonderful. And, you know, the point that you mentioned, running a VC fund in itself, especially legacy funds, which have been around for decades now, it's no less than an entrepreneurial journey. And I would like to tap onto that and know more about Avishkar Capital, you know, the genesis of the fund, if you could talk about, and you've joined them, you know, in their early days. And also tell us about, you know, what was the thesis back then and how do you think it has evolved over the years?
Yeah, so very quickly, Vijay, Avishkar Capital has about 2 decades of investing experience. And currently, as I said, we manage $400 million of assets across 6 funds and have over 60 investments and 37 full and partial exits. And overall, you know, we have generated healthy returns for our investors. But the genesis of Avishkar goes back to 2001, when Vineet, who is the managing partner, set out on a mission to drive capital to rural India. And this is around the time when most of the money was moving to urban India, because people knew only India, and rural India was a very, very different, novel, unknown concept, so to say. And he wanted to push capital to rural enterprises to create local entrepreneurship. So I guess that is what drove him to start Avishkar. It was difficult, as you could imagine, back in 2001. And it actually took us some time to raise our funds. So we raised our first institutional fund in 2007. And the first vintage fund, again, had 2 theses. One was a micro VC fund, which had a focus on rural Indian focused enterprises. And the other was a financial inclusion thesis fund, which was to invest in the then sunrise microfinance sector. And from that first vintage of funds, we went ahead and made about 30 investments. It was a very early ecosystem. We pretty much had to create and seed all these 30 companies. And now I'm quite proud to say that we've been able to create some fantastic institutions out of the investments that we made back in the day. And some of the notable investments are Equitas Small Finance Bank, Credit Access Grameen. These are some of the listed entities. Milk Mantra, which has gone on to become the largest dairy in the state of Odisha. We invested in many of the Fab India supplier companies, which were based out of Bikaner, Jaipur, Jodhpur. These were some of our notable investments from our first vintage. And then we clearly learned from that vintage, and also things evolved in the Indian investing ecosystem. And we went on to raise our second vintage funds. Again, there was significant success from our predecessor funds. And so we were able to raise a larger fund of about 125 million. Again, we tweaked our thesis a little to move from just rural focused enterprises to focus on businesses that are solving for very large, complex social problems, not just restricted to rural complex problems, but the India or the Bharat social problems. We also expanded the definition of financial inclusion beyond microfinance, because we saw the need for access to right quality products at affordable prices of financial services was a huge requirement. Again, from that vintage, we made some very interesting investments, about 22 odd investments. Some of the notable investments are Jaipur, which is an online ethnic retail brand, Suryoday Small Finance Bank, which went on to list recently, AgroStar, which is an ag tech company on the farm inputs and implements space, Let's Recycle, which is one of the largest mechanized waste management companies. So as you see, very diverse set of companies that have gone on to become quite large in the space that they operate in. Now we are in our third vintage fund, which was a 2017 vintage fund. And here our learning is, you know, we focus, we go deep into the companies that we invest. So we don't have a very wide portfolio. We only have invested in about 9 companies. And though it has just been 4 years, we've also completed one full exit from one of them. Some of the notable investments from this fund have been Utkarsh Small Finance Bank, which is an IPO candidate, Soulful, which is a millet-based breakfast cereal company, which got acquired by Tata Consumer recently, Checkbook, which is a neobank for small business owners. So these are the kind of investments we've made from our third vintage fund. And now we are on the road for our fourth vintage fund, where we are targeting a $250 million corpus. And the thesis is to invest in digital and tech-first businesses solving for the big Bharat problems, like access to finance, agri-value chains, waste management, health, education. That's what we will be focusing on. So this is how we have evolved over the years.
Wow, that's amazing. And it shows that, you know, without evolving your thesis and evolving your investment style, it's difficult to compete. You're already in your fourth fund. So that kind of puts a benchmark for a lot of VCs that that's how you play the long game. You need to adapt and keep evolving your thesis and be at the forefront of, you know, how technology and how markets are changing. So kudos to you for that. I also wanted to just double click on the fourth fund that you mentioned, which you are in now, and talk about some of the categories you are, you know, focusing on.
Both India and Bharat are growing at a very rapid pace, right? And the reason I'm saying India and Bharat, because we know there's a dichotomy in our country. But we collectively have the big target of achieving a $5 trillion economy by 2030. Yes, the pandemic has set us back by a few quarters, but the long-term story continues to be that of growth and resilience. The pace at which India is getting digitized is one of the fastest, where we are seeing digitization to be a significant equalizer. When I say equalizer, what I mean is the digital divide between rural and urban is pretty much closing the gap. Even gender divide when it comes to anything digital is almost on parity. So the factors like rich versus poor, male versus female, all of that are getting equalized with just digitization. Access to information, which used to be the trump card held by elitists, have kind of now been disaggregated. And that's just changing the entire landscape significantly. This is causing a significant social shift in the aspirations of young India. And we are seeing this aspiration move from the basic food, the clothing, the housing requirement, to access to better quality products. People are demanding better quality products, affordable products, access to all of these, right? And we all saw that in the pandemic, right? Especially in the second wave, all the gaps in our infrastructure came to the forefront. We saw how our healthcare system had broken down. We saw how, you know, insurance was so underpenetrated that it has actually pushed a significant part of our population back into poverty. Jobs and livelihoods are lost, right? So all of this has come to the forefront. And as the economy grows, the stress on the environment also will take a hit. And all economies globally have taken cognizance of this and have signed up for what are known as the Sustainable Development Goals or SDGs, where they're all committing to a cleaner planet, more equitable societies. So all of this have opened up, you know, many white spaces of opportunities, which maybe existed, but, you know, people were not focusing on them as much before. Like some of them includes clean tech. So for us, clean tech is a huge opportunity. We are talking of electric vehicles, battery innovation, waste management, reducing carbon footprint with sustainable agriculture. All of this comes under clean tech, right? And it's opening very exciting, disruptive, new gen businesses. So that's a very interesting space for us. Also, we all know, and you know so well, the India stack has taken the form it has, right? And it's opening up significant possibilities of innovation, which could disrupt supply chain businesses like never before. We all know what Aadhaar and UPI are clocking in terms of numbers. Somewhere I was reading, UPI saw close to 70 million transactions a day, which is phenomenal, right? I don't know, I can't think of another country which clocks those kind of numbers. Yes, of course, we are a very large country, we have a lot of numbers, but from a digital transaction point of view, that's fantastic. And this has led to, you know, a lot of innovation in fintech and financial services. And, you know, even 10 years back, we used to complain of having one of the lowest banking penetrations. And today we can boast that almost 90% of our population have access to a bank account, at least, right? And also the open source platforms has further improved access and services to unserved populations. This will further open opportunities to in MSMEs, health, agri, logistics. The new crop of innovations will see addressing the needs of Bharat. And that's where, you know, the confluence of various sectors with financial inclusion will play a huge role. So, you know, I can walk you through some of the companies that we have in our portfolio that is exactly addressing some of these problems, which are very Bharat problems. You know, it's not something you see outside, you can copy paste that same solution to work in India. So like, for example, you know, we have one very interesting fintech company called Checkbook. They're trying to create the neobank for small business owners, and they're redefining banking itself to the 60 million large small business community. Digital lending in this segment alone is estimated to be over $1 trillion dollars opportunity. Insurance, we all know, is highly underpenetrated at less than 4%. And this neobank is trying to address all the financial needs of small business owners by being a bank to them. So when I say a bank, they're helping them with savings products, credit products, investment products, insurance, so that the small business owner need not go, you know, from pillar to post, from money lender to insurance provider looking for the right products. It's all available at his doorstep. And the kind of growth we are seeing in these kind of digital businesses is phenomenal. Within a year of them having these products up and about, they have seen 1 million downloads. They're already clocking GTVs over $1 billion. And that's, again, the numbers are mind-boggling. That's the power of digital businesses that can disrupt things in India. Another such company is AgroStar, which is in the agri-tech space. Again, a digital-first company, almost growing at 100% year-on-year, solving for the farmer supply input problems. So I don't know if you know this, but the market opportunity is $50 billion large. And and this farmer community is a very disaggregated community. There are about 100, 150 million farmers in India. And in a short span of time, we've seen that they've already seen about 6 million downloads. And the way farmers are using digital is also shifting. And that's been a great learning for us as well. The farmer behavior has moved from just using platforms from engagement point of view to commerce. And that is where, again, huge opportunities can open up. So those are the kind of businesses that we look to back. Those are the businesses that are creating significant on-ground change in the way things have been done before.
Right. No, I think you've put it, you know, pretty well. These underserved markets are being looked at now the way they weren't, you know, looked at earlier. And with COVID and just looking at the gaps in the infrastructure, you know, there's a lot of focus that is, you know, now put on these sectors, and it's just going to help bridge that gap and open multiple, you know, layers of opportunity. And you mentioned, you know, some of these startups are serving the underserved and also trying to focus on both profits and purpose, you know, which is not always easy to achieve. And there are many businesses that are doing it at different scales. But like any other VC fund, you know, at Avishkar, you'd want to back startups that have, you know, the potential to grow 100x, not just in terms of the returns that you'll be able to make, but also in terms of the impact that, you know, they can create through the markets that they're targeting. So I want to talk about, you know, the evaluation framework at your end to select, you know, the best among these impact creating businesses that you spoke about.
Sure. No, happy to share that. And I must say that we're getting a very, very healthy pipeline. Week on week, my entire team at Avishkar Capital looks at about at least 50 to 60 companies, you know, and that's huge in terms of the deal volumes that we get. And for us to sift through it to identify which are the right impactful businesses is what takes most of our time. And we have a very stringent framework for evaluation. So, of course, there are product businesses and service businesses, and the evaluation metrics for both are very different. But at the core of it, what we need to do is we actually go into the genesis of the problem statement of what is the problem that they are looking to solve, and to understand whether something like that is creating the right positive impacts that we need to see. So deep understanding of the value chains and the social and environmental disruption the business is able to create forms part of our evaluation. And for me, it'll be easier to explain it with an example. So for example, we have a very unique agri-tech company in our portfolio called Ergos. And this company actually solves for a post-harvest storage problem at the farm gate level. So as I said, India has about 100, 150 million farmers, and most of them are small and marginal farmers. And this is one of the big problems that we have in our country. Also, the average land holding is less than 2 hectares, very, very small for a country of our size. And this creates significant production inefficiencies and losses in harvest.
Correct.
Right? And loss in harvest means it's having a negative carbon footprint because you've actually spent a lot of money, a lot of resources in trying to grow these crops. And then if there is a loss, that's a significant loss to both the planet as well as to the income, right? So the supply chain problems, you know, farmers face cause a lot of loss of income. And the first stage of loss of income happens because of lack of post-harvest storage infrastructure. So what this company is doing is to automate of the grains that the farmers bring and create a grain bank kind of an enterprise which addresses the problems. And what are the outcomes that we are seeing? We are seeing that the farmers' income has gone up by almost 40% on an annual basis, which is significant from what our farmers otherwise would have seen. And when we evaluated this company, we also realized that the positive impact on both the environment, which I said was the post-harvest loss of crop, which had a negative impact, was being met here. And also the social outcomes of increasing farm incomes, which then it leads to better lifestyle, better investments in education for their children, better healthcare, all of these are second order impacts, right? And this also further provides direct employment at farm levels, reduces the need for migration. So one of the big problems we are facing is people tend to move from farms to urban centers looking for jobs because clearly farm income is not enough to sustain families. So understanding the second and third order impact also becomes very important and very critical in the evaluation process for us.
Right. I think that makes sense. And like you said, you know, you've been evaluating and looking at 50, 60 startups every week, and you already have a big portfolio, you know, across different vintages. So can you talk a bit more about, you know, the DNA of these startups and, what differentiates them from, you know, normal enterprises, which are not so focused on impact?
Sure. See, one, there is a DNA of an entrepreneur and there's a non-entrepreneur. That's how first we distinguish, right? And entrepreneurship, right, as I said, is the most challenging journey. It's exhausting. It's lonely. It takes a lot of grit and metal to be an entrepreneur and to just keep at it. They really have to persevere a lot. However, each entrepreneur we've noticed is driven with a very different purpose, right? So what drives you is very different from what drives me. Some entrepreneurs do it for money, some do it for fame, some do it to just prove a point. There are various reasons why people take up entrepreneurship. However, what the common thread that we have seen with all our entrepreneurs who you are labeling as impact entrepreneurs has been that they are largely driven with a deep sense of wanting to make a difference and to solve for a very large, complex social problem. And often they always have a deep personal story that has led them on this journey. You know, for example, very recently, I met this great set of founders who are building a business solving for the huge migrant job problem that our country faces. And they started with creating a database for, you know, the multitude of faceless people, contract workers, who are always working in the background, you know, like the watchmen, the janitors, and so on. And normally, you know, they're not in the formal employment category. So they don't get a lot of social and financial security by employers. And it's very hard to verify them, you know, to validate where they come from, do background checks on these guys. And they just keep moving, right? Like they keep moving from one place to another, wherever it gets them the best job. And also, you know, they are very low on the skill levels and they have a lot of challenges of their own. So these guys started, you know, solving for this. And when we asked them, why did you pick this problem to solve? They told us of the journey. And it is something that affected all of us. I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago, there was this very unfortunate and sensitive incident that happened in a large metro, which involved a child and a school watchman. And actually, there have been many such incidences, but this particular incident happened in one of the founders' kids' school. So it really affected him a lot. And this was enough for him to want to quit his very high-paying job with one of the large MNCs to start to solve this problem. And we're quite happy to see the way he has put all the building blocks in place. And he's even today driven with the same purpose of wanting to solve that big problem that happened and not repeat the same problems again. So that is the common thread that we have seen with the impact entrepreneurs.
Right. And do you see, you know, a significant difference in the culture and how their own energy of wanting to create impact translates into the energy of the team and the early colleagues that they hire at the startup?
No, absolutely, Dujay. I think every entrepreneur attracts their own tribe, right? And so if it's an entrepreneur who's only driven by wanting to make money, then they tend to attract people who have a similar need or requirement, right? And somewhere, you know, if they see that cultural mismatch is there, then people move on, right? So that's how you see the core team is always aligned with the founder's vision and the founder's deep ethos that that exists. And that defines the culture of the organization. And so for many of our companies, we've noticed that the core team tends to be driven with the same sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And also one very interesting thing that we've noticed that in the businesses that we invest in, which you know, our impact focus, the attrition rate in the core team level itself will be very, very low because people have come together with a sense of purpose to solve for that problem.
And I think that's a very important factor, right? I mean, hiring is tough, especially when you are trying to, you know, sell the vision to the early employees when you don't have much to show in terms of numbers, but what you have is the energy and the vision. And from an investor standpoint, you know, like you said, you have to over-index on the founder DNA to ensure that the founder attracts the right kind of people. And that brings in more stability in terms of hiring, in terms of just the general culture at the startup.
Absolutely.
So, Sushma, I want to, you know, switch gears here and talk about, you know, a hotly debated and ever so discussed topic when it comes to venture capital. And that's exits. We know that the IPO market is still nascent, you know, while we are hearing about startups that are going to list in the next couple of years. Most of the exits today are still from, you know, M&As or private equity or larger funds buying out early stage investors. Now, given this current backdrop and the fact that, you know, in your case, impact investing funds have more patient capital, right, compared to traditional VC funds. How do you see, you know, the confluence of these two factors influence your exit strategy as a fund?
Sure. No, exits are a very, very important part of what we do. And for any investor, exits are always the focus. And commercial impact investors are no different, right? It's my constant refrain that we, as investors, we are actually in the business of exits. It's very easy to make investments. It's how to create value, and exit is what really distinguishes a good investor from a not so good investor, right? And at Avishkar, we've done about 60 odd investments in all these years, and we've done 37 exits also. And I mean, having worked on multiple of these exits, I can say it is very, very difficult because, you know, probably the ecosystem also is fairly nascent. We don't have developed capital markets like what we see in the Western world. We don't have the whole continuum of the value chain of investors ideally required to give us those kind of exits. And so those are some of the challenges that are there. But in spite of that, people only give us money if we have demonstrated as investors the ability to return money and make a lot more, right? So that's very, very critical. Every business has a very unique life cycle. Sometimes you can crunch that life cycle with the availability of the much required rocket fuel, which we call capital. In the last decade itself, impact investing ecosystem was evolving. And the players were very far and few. Many of the investors, including Avishkar Capital, had to play the very pivotal role of, you know, seeding businesses. We had to nurture the ecosystem. As I said, the first vintage fund, we seeded all the companies that we invested in because there was nothing available with solving for impact at a large scale, right? So we had to seed these companies. Hence, the average holding period was slightly longer. If we had a choice, we would have liked to exit sooner. But because the ecosystem was evolving, we had to hold it longer. Today, I'm very happy to say that the global impact investing market is at $715 billion. And ESG-focused funds are taking prominence and is expected to reach about a $50 trillion, if I'm not wrong, in assets by 2025. That means there's a lot of capital that is going to go behind these kind of businesses. So we will start seeing more participation in the value chain of impact investing, all the way from seed, pre-seed, Series A, Series B, Series C. We need that entire continuum of investors to play the role in taking these businesses forward. Capital markets need to mature, like you rightly said. We are yet to see more secondary focus fund, which is, you know, something that is very prevalent in the Western regions, where, you know, secondary funds play a very important role in giving exits to older funds. But once those players start stepping in, the continuum of investors will be complete. And this is what will also start creating more exits in this space. And of course, capital markets in India currently are on fire, right? I mean, it's still small, but the way they have been doing the last few months is really perplexing to many. In fact, two of our own companies have filed for IPO in the public markets. 10 years back when we were underwriting these companies, if someone asked us, what is your exit strategy? IPO would not feature in that conversation, right? Because we're like, IPO, who knows? It's like one pie in the sky kind of a scenario. But today it's very much a reality. We know that there is liquidity in the capital markets. We know there is room for novel assets, especially the kind of impact assets that are coming up. So macros are changing, which bodes very well for the overall impact ecosystem as well.
No, I think that helps, and that helps validate, you know, the improvement that we've been talking about. Especially coming from a fund like you, which has seen the evolution of exits in this space, especially. And the recycling of capital helps everyone, all the stakeholders involved, and helps entrepreneurs go deeper in the kind of problems they want to solve within those markets. Sushma, I want to now talk about your experience as a VC and understand, you know, you've been in venture capital for almost 2 decades now. I don't want to make you feel old, but have significant...
You just did that.
you have significant experience under your belt. So, you know, the first question I want to ask is, you know, what have been your key learnings, you know, as a VC over the past couple of decades? And how has that influenced your own personality over the years?
Sure. So, Digjay, if you remember, I started by saying I had a bias for action, and that's what led me to entrepreneurship. I must say, all these years of being an investor has taught me to become a more patient person, to be more accepting of things that are beyond my control. And even this pandemic has kind of really pushed many of us to recognize that there are some things that are just beyond your control. There's nothing you can plan for and expect to execute, right? So, so that has definitely grounded me further and made me a slightly more a patient person from the jumpy person I used to be earlier. So I guess VC investing is a marathon. You know, it's not a sprint. You have to be there for the long term. And that kind of stability also helps entrepreneurs when you have a slightly longer approach or a longer runway when you are looking to solving the kind of problems the entrepreneurs are solving for.
And I think that also, you know, gives a perspective to a lot of founders when they are, you know, deciding or at least trying to filter out, you know, what kind of funds or VCs they want to partner with. Because like you rightly said, it's a marathon. So you always want, you know, people who are patient enough to back you through the marathon and not just for the sprint. So I think that's really helpful. And one other question, you know, I wanted to ask is, what would be your advice to, you know, micro VCs and VCs that are starting their venture capital journey today?
I think nowadays, most of the micro VC, the new age micro VC founders are very, very advanced in how they look at investing, right? I'm nowhere one to give them advice. However, if I were to give myself advice about 2 decades back, would be to invest with conviction, right? And the reason I'm saying that I would have given that to my younger self is because it has taken me, you know, 15, 16 years to get to the point where I'm saying investing is all about conviction. It requires a lot of analytical rigor to form a very robust investment thesis, intuition to back the right teams. And once you've taken that decision, you should have the gumption to back your decision and make it work. And that is where conviction comes in. Yes, it requires a lot of experience, a lot of reading, a lot of, you know, seeing how things unfold, but that conviction needs to be there. Now, whether if there's any way one can crunch that timeline required to get to that conviction phase, one should invest in that. So that is what I would tell my younger self. Another thing very important for many investors is to know when to cut your losses. I've noticed many investors tend to get very emotionally attached to companies that they have seeded, invested, because for them, they almost see it as an extension of themselves. Yep. But to know exactly when things are not working, identify the problem, why it is not working, and then to move on. That takes, again, I guess a lot of experience only can help you with that.
No, I think those are some valuable points, and a lot of, you know, aspiring as well as current VCs listening to this will, you know, get a lot of value from that. You know, with that, Sushma, I want to move to our final segment for today, which is the rapid fire. And I'll shoot some questions and hope to get your honest, immediate thoughts on the same.
Sure. I'll keep them simple, please.
Okay. I'll try to. Okay. First one. One thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem today?
One thing that comes on top of my mind is the need for strengthening the domestic pools of capital. If you look around you, all the deals that are being done are by global investors coming in, right? And the Indian startup ecosystem has very heavy reliance on foreign investors. FDI in India in 2020 yep. was close to 47.6 billion. And a very small portion of this is seeing domestic fund participations. They're very far and few, and they also lack size. There's nothing wrong with external funding or foreign funding. It's fantastic. And that's what has driven growth. But external funding tends to get whimsical sometimes. And it's driven by global macro factors. So yeah. Today, India is cool. Today, India is hot. So come on, let's dump money here. Oh, now US is better. Europe is better. Some other emerging economy is better. pull all the money out, take it somewhere else, right? So that's very whimsical investing, and that's not great for the overall Indian startup ecosystem. So we need to have a very robust domestic, you know, pools of capital opening up. India should have a very strong sovereign fund of funds supporting more domestic VCs and PEs. Large corporates should also start opening up and participating in the startup ecosystem space. We've seen the likes of Google's and Cisco's. All of them are very active investors in the global startup ecosystem. So why not the Indian companies as well, right? So that's something that will make things far more robust in our country. You know, one thing when I was studying the whole ecosystem, I did see our competitor peer, the Chinese startup ecosystem. And one of the reasons why, you know, they are so strong or they have been able to build unicorn after unicorn is because they have very, very deep and wide domestic pools of capital supported by their sovereign. You know, that gives them a leg up over what we do here. So that's, you know, something that I would hope to see that could improve.
The most unusual memorable pitch meeting that you had with a founder?
Okay, this is a tough one. There have been many founders that I have met who have really inspired me, right? I mean, when you come out of a room and you feel like, wow, what an entrepreneur. But, you know, one set of people who really come to mind when you ask this question is this young bunch of engineering students. And guess what they were building? They were building a space tech solution, trying to make hyperspectral satellite imagery accessible. And at that point in time, when we met them, this technology was only available with the likes of ISRO and NASA. And these kids, in my head, I was like, these are kids. And they are like trying to take on what ISRO and NASA are trying to do. But the clarity of thought, the articulation of the problem statement, the approach towards solving problems, and most importantly, the humility of the team was one of the best I had ever seen. The confidence with which they presented, you know, there was no that fear that, you know, I know it's difficult. I'm not sure what the outcome will be. They were like fearless. They said, we are going to solve for this problem and this is how we are approaching it. You know, the most inspiring meetings I had attended. Unfortunately, as a fund, this was not an area that we invest in, but full respect for this team. And I do hope they succeed in building the next SpaceX for Bharat because we need, you know, people like these.
Last question, Sushma, of this rapid fire. VCs from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to?
When it comes to VC funds, there are many I admire. I constantly reach out to many of them just to pick their brains, whether it is TCM of Chirate and many other funds as well, Axel, Folks, Kalari, Renuka of Multiples. I mean, just respect for people who have been in this space for so long doing fantastic work.
Awesome. Sushma, this has been a wonderful conversation. And I have learned a lot from this, and I'm sure our listeners are going to take away a lot from this conversation as well. Just before we sign off, you know, any last thoughts for current and aspiring founders who are listening to you today?
I would say just hang in there. Tough times pass, and all that one requires is grit and determination and perseverance. And I just hope that you're all able to create multiple unicorns in your own ways.
On that note, Sushma, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Thanks again, you know, for taking out time. And I'm sure we'll find a way to get you back on the show and discuss, you know, many more things with Avishkar and your own journey as well.
My pleasure, Digjay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruno podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it. Share your thoughts on social media and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.